timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
So, it is Saturday once again. Saturday, the 14th of June, in the glorious future year of 2025. And all kinds of things are going on in the world right now. Some of them are positive, some of them are neutral, and some of them are, shall we say, not so great. Now, for example, let's see, a couple of long-awaited announcements. One, of course, is that Britain has finally decided to go ahead with some more nuclear energy investments, a decision which affects our friend Stug directly. 20 UTC Thursdays has a little show called Flux, where he plays an eclectic selection of music. And at other times of the day and week, when he's not in charge of a wayward group of scouts, he can be found working for the Rolls-Royce in their power systems division, which includes their nuclear power division. And they have been selected to provide small modular reactors for the new British nuclear energy push. Now, what is that going to achieve? It's hard to know. It's very hard to know. But, at the very least, we will have some, hopefully, extended commitment on the part of the British government to new nuclear investments, new nuclear construction. Again, it's not entirely clear how that's going to work out, but Britain has been sort of stuck in neutral for a long time. You know, as I've said in the past, for a number of years, Britain had the largest proportion of nuclear power in its energy supply of any country in the world, and also the largest cumulative number of kilowatt hours generated by nuclear electricity of any country in the world. The problem is the orders for all of those plants were placed before 1963. Well, no, I should say were placed before June of 1963, because I believe that the Vilfa tenders were signed, were, you know, handed in the fall of 62, and the actual contracts were signed in June or so of 63. May or June. So, you know, what is that, you know, so that was the thing, was of course, and to let you know how the British wound up in this terrible situation, the best way I can describe it is this. You know, they saw that they had a fuel problem, that they had could not produce enough coal to meet domestic energy needs, particularly because domestic energy needs were being more and more dominated by liquid fuels. So they said, let's build nuclear power plants on the basis of the Calder Hall reactors, which were even then being built, to produce plutonium for bombs with electricity as a byproduct. Well, the program for nuclear power had a target for number of stations and a target for amount of output. And as the so basically four industrial groups were formed from the various British electrical equipment manufacturers, and they designed stations to meet this program. But what they rapidly found, based on firstly experience in the building of the Calder Hall, and then experience with operating Calder Hall, and other technological advances, was that they could make the station unit sizes much larger rapidly, which brought the cost per unit of the capital cost per unit of generation, per kilowatt installed, down, and thus made their stations perform much better, because of course the economically, because of course the capital cost per kilowatt installed, is what dominates the cost of nuclear generated electricity. The fuel cost by comparison is quite small. So they met the generation target with a lot fewer stations than they expected, which was a problem because they really needed to build more stations in order to get a return on the capital that they had invested in the manufacturing plant for building those stations, right? What they call Magnox stations. Well, more orders meant one of two things. Either they had to be domestic orders, or they would have to be overseas orders. Exports. Well, domestic orders ran into a problem very, very rapidly, and that was political pressure to burn coal. The generating boards wanted to build nuclear plants and were actually required by the government to build more coal-burning power plants. Why in the world? Well, part of the reason, I'm sorry to say, you had the Labour government's for whom unionized mine workers were a major voting bloc, and they were afraid of losing their safe constituencies if coal mines were closed because less coal was required, right? Because, of course, if they're building nuclear stations faster than demand growth, then what happens? You have to stop burning as much coal. Well, Labour governments didn't want to break up their safe constituencies. Conservative governments, on the other hand, didn't want to pay money for industrial retraining schemes to take those mine workers and put them in other, generally better jobs. And so what happened? Well, what eventually happened was they limped along until Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government simply closed all the coal mines, threw the union miners out of work without any industrial retraining scheme whatsoever. Which is assuredly the pretty much one of the worst outcomes of the whole thing, right? Now, it's also true that the generating boards, specifically the Central Electricity Generating Board in England and Wales, and the South of Scotland Electricity Board in Scotland, were ordering nuclear power plants at a pretty fast clip. And pretty much all of those initial Magnox orders came before the first of the Magnox stations, Barclay and Bradwell, was actually generating. And so they had kind of put all their eggs into one basket. And you can imagine that they were hesitant to buy more nuclear power stations until they had some practical experience with them. But again, there was a gap in ordering. And of course, the other thing that happens is that during the 1960s, the price of oil worldwide was held to a quite low level, so for some countries it looked attractive to build power generating plants that burned oil. They looked like they were cheaper than nuclear generating plants. Of course, they didn't look like that after 1973, but the political risk inherent in burning oil was not properly appreciated even after the Suez Crisis. And as for overseas orders, well, unfortunately, As for overseas orders, the British government really screwed that up royally. The British industry sold a total of 2 power plants overseas, 2 Magnox plants, one at Latina in Italy and one at Tokaimura in Japan. The first 2 nuclear plants built in those 2 countries, but those were the only overseas sales they made. And a substantial part of that, I'm afraid, has to do with the British government's really ham-handed attempts at currency manipulation and economic management by currency manipulation. In fact, for example, in the 1960s, the British government devalued the pound sterling against the dollar with the idea that this would make British exports more attractive overseas and imports into Britain less attractive and thus improve their balance of trade. Boy, have we heard anything like that recently? It didn't work as intended. It actually collapsed British exports because they didn't bother to talk to the Commonwealth premiers about it first. You see, there was something called the Sterling Area. There was a whole group of countries whose currencies were tied to the pound sterling, such as the Australian and New Zealand dollar. Big export markets for Britain. Well, that shock devaluation, those countries had to cut loose from the pound sterling, and suddenly there wasn't a sterling area anymore. And so all British trade was with people they were on much less favorable foreign exchange terms with. Stupid, stupid move! So, again, Britain is making some commitments now to new nuclear construction. Good, good, good. Britain is making commitments to new industrial investments in the nuclear field. Good, good, good. But what next? I don't think we know. We're going to have to wait and see. The main thing that can be said about it is that the decision to go ahead with Sizewell C is welcomed by a lot of people. Not necessarily people in the immediate Sizewell area. I've been told that the Sizewell B construction, because it was over many more years than originally anticipated, really angered many of the local people because basically the construction workers were not the nicest people. And even right now, at Hinkley Point C construction is causing a lot of furore in the local area because of a shortage of housing and, of course, the quite well-paid workers moving in to work on the nuclear power plant are being able to pay more. And EDF is getting blamed for this, although, to be frank, I don't believe they have anything to do with British housing policy. So, it's difficult, right? It's difficult. And what about other people making decisions about money? Well, the World Bank has finally decided to rescind their ban on financing nuclear power projects. The formal ban has only been in place since like 2013 in its current form, but they actually haven't actually financed a nuclear project since 1959. They have a new announcement which says, "Electricity is a fundamental human right and the foundation of development. Jobs require electricity, as do health systems, education, clean water, public safety, and so much more. And demand will only grow as populations expand, economies industrialize, and digitalization accelerates." None of this is news, except perhaps for the term digitalization. I could have read all of that to you out of Nuclear Power magazine from Britain from 1958. I'm sorry. That's pathetic. Anyway, suffice to say, they are Now, they're not really committing to finance nuclear energy, but they're saying that where there are countries that really want to, we'll consider it. Some may choose to invest in solar, wind, geothermal, or hydro where those make the most sense. In a number of others, the best path forward may include natural gas, or, over time, nuclear. Also, let's see, we'll organize deep dives where we need a better understanding of evolving technologies like nuclear, carbon capture, and ocean energy. This is frankly stupid, all right? I don't know what else to say about it. The fact is that for a very long time, the World Bank has said, oh, well, we don't want to finance a nuclear power plant because there could be an accident of some kind, right? There could be an accident of some kind, and, you know, that's that countries which are underdeveloped don't have the infrastructure for nuclear power, blah, 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 blah. Here's the thing. The World Bank, being a bank, is not well equipped to judge these matters. Unfortunately, bankers and economists have a habit of thinking that they're omniscient, that they know everything, that they understand everything perfectly. The International Atomic Energy Agency are the people who have the job, not only of advising countries, right, but also of looking at projects and vetting them, right? See whether they're safe, whether they're a sound investment, and so on. But the World Bank has consistently refused to defer to the IAEA on the question of what constitutes a worthwhile project. They could do so much better, but they won't. Yeah, last time that they financed a nuclear power plant, in fact, the only time they financed a nuclear power plant was the Garigliano nuclear power plant in southern Italy. Again, that loan was made in 1959. It's just kind of pathetic, in my opinion. So, what next? Oh, and the new German government, although it has yet to make any real concrete moves, you know, a lot of people were expecting the coalition manifesto to say something about, hey, maybe the whole nuclear phase-out was a bad idea. Maybe we need to reactivate some of our existing nuclear power plants while they're still in a condition to be reactivated so they can go back to generating power, which we desperately need because the price of ice cream has nearly doubled. But no, they haven't done anything like that. They have, however, gently signaled to the French that they will stop being quite as obstructionist when it comes to nuclear power in other European countries. Not particularly interesting to me. I will, however, say that interesting little note here, that at Novovoronezh, which is the first Russian nuclear power plant to be equipped with pressurized water reactors, and is sort of where they do a lot of their prototyping work, they have just started loading a new batch of fuel. This fuel is perfectly ordinary in its composition. It's your typical uranium dioxide enriched pellets loaded into zirconium alloy tubing and so on. But it does have the interesting feature that it was made by complete non-contact fabrication. In other words, if you've ever seen pictures of nuclear fuel fabrication facilities, generally you've got somebody wearing a face mask and gloves actually handling the tube, the little pellets, and other components. And this new batch of fuel for Novovoronezh has been made entirely by non-contact fabrication, without a human being having to handle the various components during assembly. And what this means is that non-contact fabrication allows you to include some more powerfully radioactive things in your fuel cycle, such as higher isotopes of plutonium, such as daughter products of thorium decay, and so on. In other words, you don't have to have fuel which is as clean. And the advantage of that, basically, is that it gives you more flexibility in the closed nuclear fuel cycle, in recycling nuclear fuels which may be hot, or you may have a reason to want them to be more radioactive, for example, make it a little more difficult for somebody to divert them away from their intended destination. So, there's that. All of which is really pretty good news. And the folks in New Brunswick are talking about a second nuclear unit at Point Lepreau, although they don't know what it's going to be yet. They're talking about everything from the a new CANDU to a BWRX-300 small PWR. We'll see what it means. But, as I've often said, the people on this planet are crazy, and I want to leave. And the great example of that, undoubtedly right now, well, there's probably two examples which are ongoing just at the moment. The first is whatever is happening in the United States. I don't quite know just yet what is happening in the United States today, but certainly I have apprehensions. And the other is the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran, which is pretty much all down to the Israelis. Now, Israel has attacked Iran. It's a pure, pretty much pure act of aggression, as far as I can tell. Yes, they have attacked the Iranian nuclear laboratories at Natanz. Well, what happens next? That's an interesting question. You know, the Ayatollah, the supreme leader of Iran, has issued a fatwa, or binding religious opinion, against nuclear weapons, saying that Iran isn't going to build them, Iran isn't going to use them, etc., etc., etc. They're bad, okay? People have reason to doubt the sincerity of this fatwa. There have been defectors from Iran who have made some fairly convincing claims of active work going on toward the development of nuclear weapons. And, of course, the attitude of the Iranians towards the inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency entering their facilities has not been exactly welcoming. But Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, who is deeply unpopular in Israel itself, has seen that nobody, either within his own country or internationally, is stopping him when he orders the military to, I think we're going to be blunt about this, exterminate the population of Gaza. Nobody is stopping him, and so he's just going to keep doing his thing. And unfortunately, his thing is not kissing puppies and giving lollipops to babies, or even the other way around. He seems to have it in his mind that it's his God-given mission to bring apocalyptic violence to the world, or something. I mean, the guy is a real danger, and nobody is stopping him, and I don't know why not. Anyway, suffice to say, in addition to attacking the Iranian nuclear laboratories at Natanz, the Israelis also attacked, you know, apartment buildings because members of military units lived there and, oh, who knows what all else. It's a bad scene. It's a very bad scene. And, of course, Iran retaliates and so on and so forth. But here's what I want to say. If I were in the position of Iran, being constantly menaced by people who definitely have nuclear weapons, if I were developing a nuclear weapon at my nuclear laboratory, and I were getting close, I would absolutely move those components to some other location. Basically, if the Iranians have something they can build a nuclear weapon out of and are pretty confident of a design, I would expect to see a test detonation within the next 10 days or so. Because the Israelis have a history of attacking nuclear research facilities in other countries and not suffering any consequences for it. I would expect to see a test detonation within the next 10 days or so if the Iranians were in fact close to developing a nuclear weapon. If we don't see a test detonation, then I think we can be pretty clear that there was not an active nuclear weapons development program, or else it was stuck in neutral. Because at this point, all they have left is the ability to warn off the aggressor. Tob asks, where would they test it? There's big stretches of desert in central Iran. All they really have to do is set it off somewhere. And I'm talking an above-ground test, not an underground test, because the situation they're in warrants above-ground test somewhere that the flash will be seen by satellites and the plume of radionuclides will be detected by detectors. That's how I would do it. That would be my next step. My actual next step is perhaps going to be Archipelagon, this year's European Science Fiction Convention, which is coming up at the end of the month in the Åland Islands, which are a demilitarized zone. They are Swedish-speaking, but belong to Finland. Other than that, what do I know? I've been strongly thinking, of course, I have to finish blast number 3. It's still percolating, but I've been strongly thinking about putting out blast number 4 as a full-size newspaper, which is going to require some serious art. I'm going to have to get some serious art from somewhere. Possibly some of the artists who've contributed to the art contests run by Generation Atomic in cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency. So that's a possibility there. But other than that, I am suffering from anxiety on the grounds that intercontinental travel may become very difficult in the next few weeks or months, particularly intercontinental travel to and from the United States. I am genuinely sitting here wondering if I should try to find a last-minute airfare to depart for the U.S. on the 16th and return on the 22nd, which would give me a day of downtime before leaving for Archipelagon on the 24th, just so I can go and get some of my books, right, and other research materials, and some of my display materials for exhibits. I do not know if I'm going to have an exhibit at Archipelagon. I was very late on getting my membership, and they say, you know, application for tables are closed, but I sent them an email anyway, just in case. They're also going to have a souvenir book with advertisements in it, and I may buy an advertisement in the souvenir book. These are thoughts that I am having. Anyway, so again, don't know what my next steps are going to be. The newspaper printing thing is probably sometime in the future because I first want to have the custom telephone tokens made. Anyway, if you want to help pay for any of that, of course, you can send me money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, or a recurring contribution, patreon.com/man_and_Adam. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.